This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey everyone, it's me, Rebecca. I'm currently on maternity leave, and while I'm away, we picked out some of our earlier episodes from the No Limits Vault so that you can get caught up and enjoy while I'm off. And just so you know, I pre-recorded this, so I actually am spending time with my baby right now. Bye!
It was the first time I had to look deep within myself and say, I'm afraid. I don't want to venture outside of my comfort zone. And it's one thing to be afraid. It's another thing to feel that you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt I couldn't do the job. I just was afraid to do it.
Welcome to No Limits. I'm Rebecca Jarvis. Each week, we're talking to women playing at the top of their game. So how are they doing it? Whether you're looking for answers or you just want to hear a good story, you're in the right place. Robin Roberts, welcome to No Limits.
Thank you for being so patient.
Oh my gosh.
We tried to do this a few times.
I would wait forever for you, Robin. I look up to you. I've looked up to you for many years now.
Thank you.
I have the opportunity to work with you here at ABC, I have so much respect and admiration for you, for your career, for what you stand for.
That means so much, Rebecca. Right back at you. Tenfold,
you.
As we
Thank
say
you.
Down south.
I really appreciate that. So you're the anchor of the number one morning show, Good Morning America.
Say that one more time.
Number one. Founder of Rockin' Robin Productions. You just received the highest.
Founder? I've never been called the founder of it.
Well, I think you're the founder.
Oh, well, I did file, but it just sounds so much better. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
CEO of Rockin' Robin Productions. You just received the highest honor from the Human Rights Campaign. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Your whole family was there with you
to support you. Yeah.
And the second season of your fantastic podcast, Everybody's Got Something, just launched. First guest,
Gabourey Sidibe. We know
awesome.
Her from Precious, and she's just a wonderful woman. How are you enjoying the podcast?
Isn't it great? I love it. I love the format. I love when you get to sit down listening to you interview people, because so much of the time we get to hear you interview people for 4 or 5 minutes on Good Morning America. But these conversations that you're having with people, you're just getting so much more depth than what we can get in a short TV interview.
And it's not just the length of time also, Rebecca, getting away from the studio, getting out of the spotlight. And
no cameras.
No cameras. And you can get a real intimate look into their lives, and you can ask them things that you can't in the format at GMA. Love Good Morning America, pays the bills.
Completely.
No. Love that format, love that show, but it's just a different opportunity to allow people to express themselves. And I have a radio background. That's where I started, WFPR 14 Country, back in the day at Southeastern Louisiana University. So it was like going back home for me, and I love it. And the first season went so well with people responding, and I'm so excited that we're launching the second season.
I'm so excited too. By the way, guys, you should check this out. You can listen to it anywhere where you listen to your podcast. Robin, one thing that really does stand out to me about your podcast, about who you are, this is a career, this is a field that could make you pretty cynical about the world.
It could, yeah.
And I think that you, at least as somebody looking at your choices along the way, you've made very deliberate choices to look for the best in people, to find those stories that resonate, that people can look to as aspirational stories that will make them feel better about the state of the world. And I wonder what it was, if there was a turning point, or if maybe it was your family or your childhood that made you say, this is what's truly important to me and this is what I need to focus on.
Thank you. You get me, Rebecca. And I think that's why I've always been drawn to you personally and professionally. You want to be around people who get you. And how you describe me, and it's humbling, because I'm the daughter of Lawrence and Lucy Marion Roberts. I don't know how other way to put that's really being their child, the youngest of four, and benefiting from being the baby and having an older brother and two sisters and watching them and learning from them. My father was a Tuskegee Airman. He was the first, you know, the first military, first flying Air Corps in the military for African Americans, and he was there. And to have those role models, my mother was the first in her family to go to college. She went to Howard University on a $100 scholarship.
Wow.
Had lunch with Eleanor Roosevelt while she was there on campus, and went on to be on these different boards of director and different things in down south. And my parents were very appreciative of those who helped them, and they instilled that in us. I remember my mother telling the story of this teacher, an enrichment teacher. What is an enrichment teacher?
Right.
You know, when they're dropping all these programs now in school.
Yes.
My mother had Wilma Schnegg, who was an enrichment teacher, who was there to enrich the lives of these elementary school students. My mother leaves elementary school. She goes off to high school. And Wilma Schnegg, just for whatever reason, kept in touch with my mom. Hmm. And when my mother was a senior, she saw her and said, "Are you going to college?" And my mother said, "What are you talking about? We don't," because her mother and father had dropped out.
She hadn't even considered it.
No, because her mom and dad had dropped out in the fifth and sixth grade. And Wilma Schnegg helped her fill out the form to get the scholarship to go. So that is why I gravitate toward those stories that inspire people and give people hope, because I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. My parents would not have been able to travel the world and do the things that they did had they not been helped. And Lord knows we got enough, you know, whether it's business, politics, sports, there are these stories that are difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can find those, but to be real with them, not
right.
I don't want to be
Pollyanna. This isn't the candy coated. No.
No, sugar coating
exactly.
And going, "Oh, isn't this a great
right.
life?" It's real. And I enjoy them. And I think that there's a real need now, more so than ever. And you know what? There are a lot of these great stories out there.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people, everyday people, celebrities, everyday people all around the world who are doing some incredible things. And I just love putting the spotlight on them.
I can imagine growing up in the Mississippi Gulf Coast, given who your parents are and your siblings, the conversations around the dinner table. Obviously, Wilma Schnegg was one of those conversations.
Right.
Maybe happened a few more times than once. When you were a kid, did you want to be a journalist? Was that your goal?
I wanted to be a professional athlete.
Which is what you were doing, right?
Oh, I wanted to more than anything. Oh, my gosh. I close my eyes right now because I can see myself on the courts in Pascagoula, Mississippi. The tennis courts, and I would come off those courts. I mean, it'd be so hot, and I would have strawberries there, and I would eat them like I was at Wimbledon, and I would curtsy. I would curtsy like all these things. I mean, that was my biggest dream, was to be a professional athlete, and tennis in particular. And because I'm rather tall, basketball was put in my hands, and I played basketball. But fortunately, when I was in high school, I realized I was not going to be a professional athlete, that little thing called ability that you have to have. I mean, I had the heart and the desire. I was good. It got me a scholarship. But I wasn't going to be able to play professionally. And that's when I had to decide, oh, guys, you know how everybody says, well, find whatever it is that you love to do and find
right.
a way to get paid for it. Well, I wanted to do that. And I was told at the time, this is the late 70s, when I wanted to be a sports journalist, I said, that's going to be my way of being a professional athlete. Oh, girls don't do that.
Hmm.
I don't even want any girls, you know. And
what did you think when you heard that?
I thought, I'm sure my father was told that black men don't fly planes, and he did that. So you're going to tell me that because I'm a woman that I can't do sports? And at the time, Phyllis George and Jane Kennedy were the only two that I had ever seen on a national level or any level doing sports on television. And they did really well for what was expected of them. And I have an older sister, Sally Ann. And she was doing television, and she was the one who said, well, just go for it. Why? What do you mean you can't do that? So I look at it as when I made it to Wimbledon for ESPN, and the reason I paused is it's still a very special moment to me. When I made it there, and I didn't have a tennis racket in my hands, but I had a microphone, it was so powerful, Rebecca, because it told me, and this was still early on in my career that and life, that your dreams may not quite look like you think they will. That still, you know, when I was a kid in Mississippi dreaming of being there at Wimbledon, and I didn't make it there as a professional athlete, but I did get there, that I said, oh my gosh, you know, you've got to be, it helped me be more flexible, because being an athlete, you're very goal oriented. Mm-hmm. I had in my, for the longest time, in my bedroom in Mississippi, secret to my formula for success, I had misspelled success on this board, S-U-C-E-S-S. But I had like, you know, I'm going to do this, 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 that. And I was just very goal-oriented. And that has really helped me a great deal in many areas. But no, I didn't want to. I certainly didn't dream of being the anchor of Good Morning America. That was not anything on my radar at all. I just wanted to be a professional athlete. When that didn't happen, I wanted to be a sports journalist. And when I made it to da-da-da-da-da-da, the worldwide leader in sports, I thought that was it. But I had no idea. It was just the beginning in many ways.
Absolutely. And by the way, I think you're selling yourself a little short, because you played basketball at Southeastern Louisiana. You were the top scorer. You were one of the best ever.
I did
at
really,
Southeastern,
right? I had 1,000+ points and rebounds and all that good stuff. And I was very fortunate to receive some accolades. And I'm in the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame, but as a contributor. I'm in the Hall of Fame. You still got time. I know. I had to pause. I was like, I got to be honest, Robin. It's not as a player, as a contributor. But I was a good athlete. I did have an opportunity. My senior year of high school, when I was in college, I knew that there was not going to be a professional. I love the WNBA and the fact that it's been around for as long as it has, and to be a part of ESPN to launch it back in 1997. That's great. When I graduated from college in 1983, there was not a professional league. We had to go to Europe, and I was receiving offers to go to Europe and play basketball. At the same time, I received a part-time offer for $5.50 an hour, 30 hours a week, to be the weekend sports anchor in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And I was like, I'm going to take that, because I do dream big, focus small. I'm like, am I going to go to Europe and, you know, continue playing? And why? And I have this opportunity, though it's a part-time job, but I knew it could lead to bigger things. And it was fun, too, when I was working in local markets and they would have these local pickup games, basketball games, and the guys didn't know that I had my back.
You show up as a total ringer.
Yeah, like... I did. I would show up going, oh, I don't know. And they go, let's let Robin play. And I looked in, yeah, so it had its benefits. Yeah.
Did anyone at that time when you were, I mean, you got the opportunity to go to Europe, you ultimately decided not to. Did anyone at that time think you should have chosen Europe instead?
No.
Okay,
yeah.
So it wasn't one of those decisions where a lot of people were saying one thing and you chose the
alternative.
No.
I had, you know, my parents, I think of them every day. They are cheering me on from their heavenly balcony every day. And, you know, when I walk into the studio at GMA, I blow them a kiss each morning. They were really cool parents. First of all, they did not want to be my best friend. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, though, when I was having these opportunities, and I got more heat in not taking a full-time job in news journalism. I was getting full-time offers in news for benefits and a bigger salary, and I got more heat for not taking that and taking the part-time job for $5.50. There are more people who are saying, not so much the basketball. They were like, why aren't you taking this full-time position in news? And at the time, I was like, news is a four-letter word. I don't want to do news. I want to play sports. I want to be involved in sports. And my parents, and I know that they also were thinking like, honey, broadcasting is broadcasting. What are you doing here? But they allowed me and helped me financially. You know, there's only, mm-hmm. they were still extending, giving me, I think it was $75. I remember my first apartment cost $242 in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And because it was, it had to be, yeah, it was $242, and that was my entire salary. And so my parents helped me out, and I was there for 9 months and then went on to a bigger station. But I really appreciate it that they never put pressure on me to, you know, go play ball across the pond to take the full-time job in news. They just wanted all their children to be happy.
That is Very lucky.
Yeah.
So when you're in this role and you start bouncing around to different sports positions, different sports anchoring jobs,
right.
How are you thinking about those moves? And is it in the back of your mind, I want to get to ESPN? Okay, so that's part of it the
it
whole
time.
It
was on the success board.
You have a success board.
It was on the SUC, ESS success,
okay.
The misspelled success board. No, I had said I wanted to be in a small market, then a medium-sized market. I had ESPN on that vision board. And so I was in Hattiesburg for that 550 job for 9 months, then went to a bigger station in Biloxi, Mississippi. Then I went to Nashville, Tennessee in 1987, was the Lifestyles reporter. I didn't realize, but I was quite a little businesswoman even back then because I knew I needed to get out of that market and get to somewhere bigger. And I remember my parents were doing a lot of traveling for church business. And so they told me they were going to Nashville, Tennessee, and I knew I could stay in their hotel room. So I sent my tapes to the news directors in Nashville and said, I'm going to be in town, not going to cost you anything. Do you mind if I come by? Didn't ask for a job, just wanted
to. So smart.
Yeah. And there was one station, WSMV, the number one station in Nashville, who Alan Griggs, I remember him very well, Alan Griggs, he said, sure. I went by and he looked at my tape and he said, you know, there's something here. And he created a position. He said, go back. I'm going to work on something. And so he worked out and he didn't have anything on the books for via news or sports, but he had something for a Lifestyles reporter. So I went there, did so well that the competition sent my tape to get me out of the market because they didn't want this. So they sent my tape. Then I got an offer from ESPN in 1988, they offered me a position, and I turned ESPN down.
Why?
I'd only been out of school for a few years. I'd only worked in three stations, two in Mississippi, the one in Nashville, had never covered any professional sports. I did not want to be the answer to a trivia question. I didn't want to be what black woman was hired and fired within a year at ESPN, and that would have been me. I didn't do the work. And I think it's so important to know your strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And I wanted staying power, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to just get there. I wanted to stay there.
Yeah.
And so I said, thank you, but no thank you. Kept in touch. Went to Atlanta, GA for two glorious years. V103, Mike Roberts in the morning. Yeah, Mike Roberts was the news guy, the DJ, and I did the sports.
How
and
fun.
V103 and did television. And ESPN came calling again, and I knew I had done the work, and I was at ESPN for 15 years.
So 1990 is the year you make it to ESPN.
1990 is the year I make it to ESPN. So I did have a strategy. I was working it. I had in my mind, I dream big, and I still do. I set really humongous big goals, but I do those day-to-day things. I focus very small in reaching that. And that's what I was doing when I was going from Hattiesburg to Biloxi to Nashville to Atlanta to ESPN. And then the beauty of it, Good Morning America, ABC, had no idea. And so it taught me that you can have this game plan.
Yeah.
But then you also have to be flexible. Then you also have to be able to, first of all, put yourself in position. Proximity is power. You can wish, hope, and pray all you want. Very spiritual. But you have to put yourself in position. And being involved with this company and just showing up and just trying to do my very best that other people wanted to see me do some other things. It's commonplace now, but back then, when you were at ESPN, you stayed there. You didn't do, people now are all these different networks.
Everything's moving.
Yeah, and even like being able to do a podcast like this. Before, I love how we're able to really be able to expand and really show all the different gifts that we have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you're at ESPN, at what point does the ABC opportunity materialize?
I was at ESPN in 1990. Strictly ESPN, nothing else.
What was that moment like, by the way, very first hit on ESPN?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you, because you're bringing me back. I like to think that I still have that adrenaline and that kind of joy, but oh my gosh, especially in the early days. I mean, you see the behemoth that ESPN has become. Back then, we were like in trailers and had like one little, there was no makeup and hair.
Right. You
know, we did it our own. So we did our makeup in the bathroom before we go out to the.
There was also no HD.
No, so that's right. That I know, too. Really. I know that. That I didn't mind that there was no HD. But there was just such joy because all of us came from local television where sports was looked upon as the unnecessary evil, you know, as far as the 30-minute newscast. Mm-hmm. We would get 2 or 3 minutes. And then you go to a place that that's all you did. And that was all.
And everyone cares about that
Everybody
thing, too.
Cares about it equally. So it was just a joy. And I remember the first time that I did the, because everybody back then started on the overnight, the 2:30 a.m. Eastern time. Sports Center, and it only aired. It didn't re-air in the morning like it does now, but it was only on at 2:30 a.m. Eastern time. And my folks down in Mississippi would get up and they would watch it.
I love that.
And the first time I did a primetime Sports Center, it was a few months after that, Chris Berman, Boomer, the Chris Berman, I did it with him the 6 o'clock for the first time. And he had been in Hawaii for all those few months that I had started, because it was after football, he did football. His children weren't in school yet. And so he, after football season, he'd stay in Hawaii for a couple of months. Nice gig, right?
Yeah.
All right. So he's back. It's my first 6 o'clock. I'm meeting him, in essence, for the first time. But he had been watching me because of the time change. He had seen those 2:30 Sports
Center. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't 2:30 for him.
It wasn't 2:30 for him. And so he saw me and he respected me. And I'm telling you, Rebecca, I could tell that men, especially who watch and still primarily watch ESPN, they were looking at Chris Berman. They were looking at him like, okay, if she's okay with him,
wow,
then she's okay with me.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for all the men and women that I worked with at ESPN, especially the guys in those early years who treated me as an equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, really helped set the foundation. So I did the original Dream Team in Barcelona in 1992, covered Wimbledon, the U.S. Open, Final Fours, the list went on and on. And then there was, do you remember ABC's Wide World of Sports?
Of
the
course.
Thrill of Victory, The Agony of Defeat. I was the host of that for a moment. And that was a big deal for me to still be at ESPN. Mm-hmm. So at one point, I was an anchor on ESPN Sports Center and the weekend anchor for Wide World of Sports. Little old girl from Mississippi.
Wow.
And being in the house here at ABC and people watching me do Wide World of Sports, then it was like, oh, you're here. Can you do GMA Sunday? Can you do a little lifestyle or so? Yeah, it turned from doing a sports story to a lifestyle story to being the news anchor in 2002. That's when I kind of officially joined the Good Morning America family in 2002.
To your point, though, from earlier, proximity is power.
Yep.
And once you get your foot in that door, that's the key. You weren't necessarily, you know, I need to work at Good Morning America. It was ESPN was the dream.
Right.
And yet you never really know.
Well, don't you find with the number of people that you talk in business that you kind of have an idea of what it is that you want to do or the service that you want to provide and all that. And then things happen, but you have to, again, that's why I say proximity. You have to be at least in the position. Mm-hmm. This is how I looked through playing. I learned so much through playing sports. We would play a team that on paper should just, they were supposed to kill us. They were just supposed to. And our coach would say, just stay close to them. Just, you know, keep the score as close as you can, because in the end, you never know, you get that break. If you go into that game thinking, okay, they're gonna kill us, and you don't even try, when you had those breaks, they weren't going to mean anything because you're so far behind. So just stay in the game. Just stay in the game and just hope for some kind of a break or of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I've always looked at my career. It's like I've done a lot of the work, but I've got to have some breaks along the way. And if I go ahead and position myself for that. And being here at ABC and doing Wide World of Sports that turned into GMA and everything else, I never really, like I said, I never, I never really thought of that. Billie Jean King is a very dear friend. And I remember when I had the opportunity, because when I was still at ESPN, I was when I started at GMA doing the news anchor job in 2002, I was still anchoring at ESPN. I was not going to give up my day job because I still didn't know if this was going to work out. And then when I was offered to be the anchor with Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer, little old Robin Roberts was going to be the third anchor. I remember the folks at ABC said, "Will you now leave ESPN? Now will you leave us?" And I asked Billie Jean King, and I thought that she would say, "You know, no, stay in sports." And she was like, "Of course. Why would you not?" And then, Rebecca, it was the first time I had to look deep within myself and say, "I'm afraid. I don't want to venture outside of my comfort zone." And it's one thing to be afraid. It's another thing to feel that you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt I couldn't do the job. I just was afraid to do it. And
what were you most afraid of? We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
What were you most afraid of?
I was most afraid of people saying or people feeling, why? Charlie, Diane, what? What? I had worked so hard in sports. I had worked so hard to get that position at ESPN, and I'd earned that right.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just so fearful that people would not take me seriously. Why would that matter because I knew
you spent the time building the journalism career.
Exactly.
How did that in any way change your behavior, especially early on at GMA? Do you feel like you were working harder than you might have if the job had come to you maybe through a slightly, in quotation marks, more traditional path?
I don't know. I've always been a hard worker.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I would have approached it any differently. But I know that because of my sports background and being a woman in sports, the margin of error was non-existent. And I would often laugh with my male colleagues, because back in the day, as a woman in sports, you had to, as a sports journalist, you had to be a former athlete. You had to be, you couldn't.
There was no other path to
it. Right. I mean, they, for credibility, you had to be. But yet, my male counterparts, and I would laugh at them. I'd said, "You haven't played since you got cut from Little League. I made it almost to the pros. You got cut in Little League, but yet people think you have more experience, more knowledge,
credibility, or whatever,
exactly, than I do." But you know what? I use that as a positive.
Yeah.
And I said, "You know what? I am going to be prepared. I am going to be ready." So I think the nervousness was because it was outside of my comfort zone in that sports. I know cold. Even to this day, I mean, I just know everything about it. I love it. I eat it. I breathe it. And it wasn't that way at the time in news. I had a knowledge of what was going on in the world, but it wasn't a passion of mine. It was an interest, but not a passion. And so I was a little bit insecure in that regard. But more than anything else, this is what I love, and it's so important for people to understand. We're all afraid. All of us are afraid. And the courage is to do it anyway. It's not that the fear ever leaves. It's just that I'm going to still do it. And that's the approach I had to take, that I'm going to do it. And I'm so grateful. I'm so incredibly grateful that I did, and had no idea of the opportunities that were going to be there waiting for me.
I think it's such a good lesson. Even if things go wrong, there's always the ability to overcome. Even if there's a mistake, even if there's a failure, you know the more that you fail that you're going to move forward. You know the more that you try that it's not all going to be the end of the world if things don't go exactly the way you were expecting them to.
And I loved especially the local markets where I worked. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I'm so glad that tape. I mean, like nowadays.
Have you ever watched any of those tapes?
I haven't
gone back and watched any of my like earlier stuff anytime recently.
How did you get started?
I actually started at CNBC, and I think I've been listening to your story a lot and thinking how similar in some respects your story and my story are, because I always wanted to do business news. You know, the really specific industry business
stuff. What was it about? Business and what? Why you wanted to do
that? That's a really good question. My mom is a journalist, and she covered personal finance and really taught me a lot about money and things like that growing up, and how to save money and how to be frugal and how to, she taught me how to get by with not a lot. But CNBC was my dream. So when I got to CNBC, it was like, this is the best thing in the world. And when I eventually came over to the network side, it wasn't the thing that I had always dreamt of. CNBC was the thing I had always dreamt of.
ESPN for me, right.
And so it makes sense to me along the way how you had this choice, and you were, most people on the outside looking in would be like, of course you would take the Good Morning America job, right? Of course. But it isn't necessarily that simple, because it's what do you want, and what's your goal, and what's your dream? I want to come back to your story, because something you said earlier struck me. So you were talking about how in sports you played this team that on paper should have beat you.
LSU is the team, yes.
LSU. Yeah. There you go. So on paper, they should have beat you. And for whatever reason, as you were saying that, it resonated with me when you got sick. So on paper, getting sick when you were diagnosed with cancer and then later MDS, these are things that can beat you. And on paper, they definitely statistically can beat you.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much of that sort of earlier spirit might have even played into your belief, which at least on the outside looking in, it appeared that you always had that fighting spirit.
Oh, wow. You do get me. And I mean that, Rebecca. I approached it much as I did as an athlete, that I'm very coachable. My doctors were my coaches, set my goals. I get a little weepy when I think about it, because it is hard to hear the stats. It is hard to, I remember Amber, my partner and I, going in to see the doctor for the second go around, because
you thought you had made it through hump.
Right. In 2007, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I know a lot of people who get breast cancer. Oh, okay. So I had I had some people I could look to that were successes and could show me the journey of getting through it. And yes, had chemotherapy, had radiation, all that. So I get through that, feeling good. You know, I made it. Had a particularly aggressive form, it's called triple negative, meaning that they don't know how you got it. And so there's no additional treatment after the radiation and chemotherapy. But by the grace of God, I got through that. And then this myelodysplastic syndrome, which used to be called pre-leukemia. There's nothing pre to it, but it is a blood cancer. And it was brought on by the treatment. The very treatment that saved my life was now putting it in jeopardy. And I remember Amber and I being at the doctor, and it's not really computing with me. What is this? Because breast cancer, I knew what that was. And so he wasn't getting our attention, and he knew I was a stat person. So he puts all my information in a computer, and he turns the screen to us, and there is a graph. And there's a 1, 2, 3, 4, and there's a dot between 1 and 2. And I said, what is that dot? And I said, he goes, that is your life expectancy if you don't have a successful bone marrow transplant. I was like, you've got my
between
attention.
Between 1 and 2.
One years. And 2 years. So that was 1 and 2 was the years.
Oh my
and
gosh.
It was right between that. And to be told, you're sitting there and being told that statistically you might not make it to the second year unless you have a successful treatment, and not realizing how difficult it is to find a donor.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I have siblings, is going to be an automatic. Well, that only happens 30% of the time, a blood relative, which means 70% of the time you need someone off the registry. Thank the good Lord, one of my sisters,
Sally Ann
was a perfect match, and it went well. But how I approached it was very much like it was the opponent. It was LSU, if you will. I love LSU. I'm not ragging on LSU. Lying up though, Southeastern lying up. So I looked at it as my opponent. My doctors and nurses, they were the coaching staff,
mm-hmm.
It was as much mental as it was physical. I mean, it was physically grueling, but it was much mental as it was physical. And I thought about, Robin, you know, people said you should not be a sports journalist. People said, you know, all these no's that you heard, but you never believed it. Your family never believed it. So you're not going to let some computer tell you that you're not supposed to be here in 2 years. And so I just faced it the same way that I faced everything in my life. And I think it really... Because I am the daughter, as I said, of Lawrence and Lucy Marion Roberts. I wish you could have met my parents, Rebecca.
I would have loved to meet them.
That little family model, we don't have it all together, but together we have it all. And that was it. They didn't get everything right, but just how you talk about your mom, my mother and father, I remember whenever I would want something, I remember... going back to elementary school, you're much too young to remember the banana seat stingray. It was a particular bicycle that
I know what you're talking about.
Okay. You saw it on Seinfeld. That's
yeah,
why you
sure.
remember. I remember that was the bike everybody had to have. I was in the third grade, so my parents, they gave me the bike, so I had it. And I didn't really take care of it, and it stayed out in the rain. And the next year, you had to get a 10-speed. English ratio is what we call it.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have a 10-speed the next year. So I go to my parents and said, okay, you know, I'm still a good kid. I want the 10-speed. They're like, no, you're going to raise money, and you're going to earn it, and you're going to buy it yourself. Because we gave it to you, mm-hmm. and look what you did to the other one. I was like, oh, it took me 2.5 years, $97.52, go down to Swin Dealer on Pass Road in Gulfport. And I plucked down that money, got that 10-speed, and had it through junior high, high school, college. And I didn't even realize that they taught me, like, when you have to earn it,
yeah,
you're going to treasure it and treat it so much better than if something is given to you. And so they always were giving us these life lessons that have really, really set a very strong foundation for all their children.
Wow. They sound like incredible human beings. They sound really, really cool. Your sister, obviously... is pretty cool too.
Yeah, she saved my life. Okay. And I remember, I know my brother and my sister Dorothy, they're like, oh gosh, how many times do we have to hear
right.
how Sally Ann saved your life? But yeah, she did.
When you look back, what's been the toughest lesson you've had to learn?
Oh, that's a good one. The toughest lesson I had to learn, that God's delays are not his denials. I would always feel like I always wanted something and I didn't get it. And I had to realize that there was something that better, not even necessarily better, but something that was more destined for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard, because I don't know about you, but there are many times, oh gosh, you know, whether it's a position or
you
whatever.
You worked so hard
yes,
for it.
Right. And you're like, you earn it and you don't get it. And
yeah.
You just, I hated that feeling. And so the hardest lesson was to learn to let go.
When did you learn that?
Ooh, it took some time. It took, I would say, when I was at ESPN, and it was hard to let go of ESPN.
Mm.
It was really hard. To this day, especially men, they're in the studio, you with us at GMA, you know, and we had that live studio audience,
right.
And they're great, and we're taking pictures during commercial breaks and that. And every now and again, a guy will whisper in my ear, why'd you leave? Why'd you, you're like, what were you thinking? Like, not, you know, they're glad that I'm doing what
sure.
I'm doing. And it was really hard to let go and to know that there was something, to believe mm-hmm. that there was something more for me. But I'm really, it makes me think of the song that I wrote with India Arie. You know, life is a journey, not a destination. Mm. There are no mistakes. This chances we've taken lay down our regrets because all we have is now. I had to learn that. I had, there's many times that, even now when I get down about something, and Amber, sweet Amber, will say, didn't you just speak to like 1,000 people? And oh, would you please listen to your own speech? You know, why are you so?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm
laughing because my husband and I have these conversations all the time. And he'll say to me, you know, you just had like the best week ever.
Right.
And now you're focusing on this one thing that didn't work out the way that you wanted
it
to.
I know.
But that is good advice. And I think that the reason I like it coming from you is because most people look at Robin Roberts, mm-hmm. the Good Morning America anchor, former top of the line ESPN anchor, mm-hmm. Inducted into the Women's Hall of Fame, the Walter Cronkite Award winner.
That meant a lot. Yeah, thank you.
You've done it all. You best-selling author, podcaster. You've done it all, and it's hard to see on the outside looking in. I think the fact of the matter is, it's not this seamless upward trajectory of a path.
Well, that's what's so important. That's why I love my podcast so much as well, because I want people to know, because I think I don't know why some people feel that when they look at someone that has reached a level of success, whatever mm-hmm. that is, that the road has been easy, that they're
right.
never fearful and all that. And I just want to pull back the curtain on the podcast. No, that's not the truth.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, and Gabourey Sidibe said something very interesting in the podcast. She was as fearful of succeeding as she was in failing.
Mm.
I was like, whoa. Because, you know, Precious came out. I mean, they put Precious together, the movie that she
yep.
became nominated. But it took a long time before it actually got on the screen. So she knows this movie is going to come out and everyone is saying it's going to change her life. But in the meantime, she's still trying to make ends meet. She is fearful of, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen if it is a success?
Mm-hmm.
Success? What's
mm-hmm.
going to happen to me? And I never thought about being fearful of success as much as failure. So I love telling my story and showing people others' stories about how we are all, fear just takes the eye of a needle to get through, and it just permeates and takes over everything and can be paralyzing. And I am a firm believer that to tell people that everyone feels this fear, and just don't let it win.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't let it win. I don't like to lose. I don't like to lose, and I'm not going to let it.
And that's one thing you can actually control.
You
at
can.
Least, I mean, as hard as it is, is there anything outside of talking to Amber, who sounds like an incredible partner?
She's all right.
Don't
make my life even more miserable. She'll hear that.
But is there anything? Do you have any practices that help you when you feel the fear creeping in?
Meditation. Yeah, meditation has helped. I started a little over a year ago, and that has been very beneficial. I actually get up earlier in the morning. I already have to get up early. I get up at 3:15 a.m. At 3:30, I do a half-hour meditation from 3:30 to 4. I try and get in a second one, and Dan Harris can go on and on and talk.
Well, you did. I loved you on his podcast,
oh, wow.
talking on 10% Happier about this, too.
It was just, it's really been beneficial. It has, it's so odd because it calms you and energizes you at the same time. And I have found that has been so incredibly beneficial. But my faith, I really mm-hmm. have to say, I have one of those. Even when I was going through those darkest hours, and 2012 was a horrendous year for me. That's when I was diagnosed with MDS. My mother, almost dies in my arms a week before I'm supposed to have this procedure. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just like, I just want to leave. It was just this horrible, horrible year. And I remember people often asking me, because they know I'm very spiritual, they're like, well, you know, what was your faith shaken? And I'm like, Yeah. But you know what? God can take it. I was mad at him. But you know what? He can take it. I'm not gonna lie and say I wasn't upset and I wasn't pounding my fist and saying, not so much why me, but why is this happening? Mm-hmm. And I am so incredibly grateful that I have this bedrock of faith. It's just so real. I saw this with a dear friend. Part of the reason I don't want to get into great detail, but one of the reasons we had to reschedule. Talking with you, I had to talk at a service for a friend who lost a child in the most unimaginable way.
Yes.
And I was watching my friend and just this, I mean, her child was taken from her. And to be in this church and to hear the pastor and to see my friend and to see her get up there and speak. And so I know faith is real. And it doesn't mean that we don't hurt. It doesn't mean that we're not scared. But at the end of the day, my faith, and I've said this over and over again, when fear knocks, let faith answer the door. And that has gotten me through to be where I am right now. And I am so grateful that my parents, again, it always goes back to my parents, that they instilled that in me.
Well, my next question was too light for
that.
No, I will come to it. It'll be the final question.
See, that's the beauty of me. You can be like, remember when
love that.
When you did, what was this the other, you were doing the morning wake-up call, and you were light and heavy, and I got into this all deep stuff, so it's all
I
good.
Love it. It's no, all it's good. All good. It's all good. So I've got two questions left. If there's anything in terms of your dreams that comes next for you,
ooh,
are you thinking about anything else that's really big?
Am I thinking about anything that's really big? I am very excited about this new medium. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about, you know, when people keep saying that the television is a dinosaur, you know, the cord cutters, and a lot of my nieces and nephews are cord cutters. I'm excited. I have recently, I look at uncertainty as endless possibilities.
Mm,
you know
I like
what?
That.
You know,
yeah,
I do.
Yeah, totally.
These are uncertain.
Clever and creative people can do a lot with uncertainty.
Yes. And you know, as a business person.
Yes.
That's when you want to make a killing in the stock market.
Yeah.
I know, even though you always tell me, I love this when you say, you know, the stock market hates uncertainty.
Right.
And that's when, you know, I do listen to you.
But I appreciate that. And Warren Buffett always says, when everyone else is running for the exits, that's when you go in.
That's it. So that's how so I'm excited about the different kind of opportunities that could be there. I don't know.
All right. Last question. Great. I ask everybody. This has been a very positive, optimistic interview, but I am curious about the worst advice you've received, because I also think people get a lot of bad advice, sometimes from very well-intentioned people, and I wonder what the worst advice you've received along the way has been.
Let me think about that, because that's a good, the worst advice that I have ever received, the worst advice. I was thinking about Southeastern. I was supposed to transfer to Tulane, but I'm glad I stayed at Southeastern. So that went. Gosh, what do people normally say when you ask them that?
So it's interesting.
Wow, I like that.
A lot of the time, it's people who are trying to protect you from taking risks. So, you know, I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of women have been told by family, by loved ones, don't leave the cushy job. Instead, stick to the company job where you've got the pension or the 401k and the health insurance, and don't go out and start the company that you want to start on your own.
Sometimes I get a little, I remember I was speaking somewhere and, the person came up to me and they said something along the lines of, you got to have something a little different. I mean, these kids have gone through a lot. And so if you could, you know, can't be all that good. And I listened to them and I said, I'm not going to apologize for having a good upbringing. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I that doesn't guarantee anything. And it wasn't all roses, but no, I'm not. No, mm-hmm. I had a good upbringing. Mm-hmm. I made mistakes, and my parents, I got spankings and things like that. But I'm not gonna apologize for that. And I think that helped me all along the way, in that I've always been able to, in the most dire circumstances, find something. And I do believe that people are well intentioned. And so I think why I kind of, you know, about that, anybody who gave me bad advice, I have a really good kind of, you know, instinct, and I probably don't remember because it just went in one ear and out the other.
Yep. But yeah. even the piece of advice that you were given before that speech, this kind of idea, like, don't be entirely true to yourself, Robin.
Yeah.
Just make it a little spicier. I think that personally, listening to it, you didn't dub it.
That's true.
Bad advice. But I think that was not, I hear this a lot. People who are pushed in this direction to do something outside of themselves, to be inauthentic. That's bad advice.
That is bad. So I did get bad advice.
You did it, Robin.
Okay, good, good. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you. This was, I'm seriously blown away by this conversation. I am so grateful and honored that you would spend time with us here on No Limits. And I love your new podcast. Again, it's Robin Roberts. Everybody's got something. You can find it here where you're listening to this podcast. And Robin, people can find you. I'm sure everybody who's listening is already following you all over social media, but it's at Robin Roberts everywhere.
Right. That's right. Because there's no limits when it comes to Robin Roberts. No limits.
No limits.
Oh, that's Rebecca.
Yeah.
See that?
Limitless, baby. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
I'm very excited about this. It is our first international No Limits entrepreneur. Carol Barrett comes to us from Brampton, Ontario, and is the founder of Fluency 365, an online platform that helps you to learn a foreign language by practicing virtually with animated characters. Such a smart idea. Carol came up with the idea when she couldn't find anyone to practice Japanese with and wanted to eliminate that as an excuse for not learning. Fluency 365, like the name would suggest, offers 365 interactive conversation sessions and 365 video lessons to ensure you're understanding each conversation every day of the year. Carol, thanks for sharing your story and for being a part of the No Limits community, which I guess now extends to Canada. That's awesome. Remember, you can send me your nominations here at nolimitswithrjpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening to another episode of No Limits. If you like what you heard, please make sure to leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. And don't forget, you can follow along with us behind the scenes on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat at Rebecca Jarvis. Special thanks to the team here at ABC that helps make this happen. Taylor Dunn, Michelle Buncardo, Josh Cohan, Andrew Kelb, Steve Jones, Annie Osakwe, and Elizabeth Hecht. And join me next Tuesday for an all-new episode of No Limits with Rebecca Jarvis. Until then, take care, be well.